Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. This is the first show of the rest of our lives. I hope you enjoyed our 100th show with Roseanne Barr last week. And today we have two strong female guests, so we're going to get right into the interview. Our first guest is Green Party candidate for California's governor in 2010, Laura Wells. Laura and I recently traveled to Venezuela together to protest the U.S.-imposed sanctions there. Laura Wells, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thanks for having me, Cindy.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you again. I introduced you as a person that I recently traveled to Venezuela with, and we had about 20 hours traveling time, so we got to know each other quite well.
Right. Oh, that was great.
And so I'm going to give my listeners a chance to listen to you and some of your positions. So, Laura, what is your assessment of the Brown administration so far?
Well, what Brown is doing, he is not taking advantage of a wonderful opportunity that he has and that California has. I mean, to begin with, California is a wealthy state. There is no reason that we're in the fix that we're in. And what Brown is doing is coming to the people and saying, well, I want you to be able to vote on your taxes, and I'm really fighting with the Republicans so that you can vote on taxes. And the taxes that he is proposing, as opposed to what the kind of taxes that people want, the taxes that he's proposing are an extension of taxes that were brought in by his Republican predecessor, Schwarzenegger.
Right.
And they are taxes on the middle class and the lower income people. They are not taxes on the wealthiest 1% or even the 5%. And so he is presenting that as if it's some sort of an enlightened approach to let the voters decide on what taxes they want to put on the people that have the least money. Whereas the people are beginning to soften up their idea about taxing the rich, and that is becoming a much more prevalent idea, even among people that paradoxically before, people didn't want to put taxes on the rich, sort of as a philosophical thing, because, who knows, the polls showed that maybe a third of the people thought that at some point I will be very wealthy.
Uh-huh.
And people have become aware of the fact that the money is just concentrating. The disparity is growing, and people are being left out and shut out of more opportunities. Look at what's happening with the schools. So there's something also that happened a month ago in May. There was this $6.6 billion windfall. And what that was, and so Brown revised his budget plan, and what that was a windfall because they had not anticipated that the income would be so high on the upper income people, and that therefore the taxes that would come on that would reach to $6.6 billion. So it wiped out almost, more than a third, close to a half of the $15 billion deficit.
And the $15 billion deficit was after the Democratic legislator proposed by our Democratic governor cut $13 billion of
right.
essential social services and education, right?
Right, right. And what they're doing is the game that's being played both at the federal level and at the state level. It's real close to us. The game that's being played is that the Republicans blame the Democrats, and the Democrats blame the Republicans. Now, of course, the Republicans, and then they just bat it back and forth and say, there's nothing we can do because of them. There's nothing we can do because of them. And then the people that lose are those of us that get the cuts in services, even in potholes and state parks, as well as libraries and schools and health care and help for our seniors and disabled. So now the Republicans' reason for blaming the Democrats is that the Democrats are in majority. There are seven constitutional offices And guess how many of them are Democrats?
Seven.
100. Yes, 100%. Seven of them. Good guess.
That's an easy
so
guess.
Seven of them are Democrats. I mean, it seems like the folks in Wisconsin would say, "Whoa, you know, they must be in heaven in California." So seven of the seven offices are Democrats, and there's a majority in both houses of the legislature, both in the Assembly and in the Senate. There are strong majorities of Democrats. So that's why the Republicans would say, hey, you know, any mess-up that there is, it's the Democrats. Now, the Democrats blame the Republicans because there's this thing called the two-thirds majority
to raise
revenue. And there used to be another two-thirds majority, and that was to approve the budget. Well, that got fixed last year. That wasn't the biggest problem, however. You know, that had been around since 1933. But that got changed to a simple majority. But when the focus shifted from changing both of those two-thirds majorities to be just a simple Democratic majority, so that the people of California can be in the driver's seat, so that we can choose what we want with a majority rule rather than minority rule. So what happened last year was that people were tracking trying to get both of those two-thirds majorities to be a thing of the past. And what happened? Well, Jerry Brown helped to derail the one to raise revenue, and just the two-thirds majority to pass the budget passed. So what happens is that a two-thirds majority to raise any kind of taxes and a simple majority to lower them in boom years, they'll vote all day long to lower taxes, and the primary beneficiaries of lowering taxes, the richest of the rich, individuals and corporations. And yet to get it back, it takes two-thirds. When we really need it, it takes two-thirds. And that's virtually an insurmountable barrier. So what could the Democrats be doing? What could Jerry Brown be doing? He's got the biggest microphone of any political person in this state. I don't think there's anybody else that comes close. So he's using that resource of his. And by the way, he was the one that was governor when this two-thirds to raise revenue came in.
Uh-huh.
So there's a certain, there would be a certain restorative justice if he were the one to take it out. But he could lead the charge, and with the other six constitutional officers that are also Democrats, with the majority in both houses of the legislature, and say, look, you know, we are tired of what's happening to California, and we're going to take the case to the Californians and explain to them what they're already understanding. But we are going to say, Prop 13, you know, that beloved Prop 13, there's a little piece of it that has been really good to you that loves you back. And that part is the part that helps people stay in their homes, especially seniors on a fixed income. Basically, that's why people voted for it in 1978. They said, whoa, people were losing their homes because of property taxes.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a good thing, and that's something that we can fix. We can have it be better than it is right now, because seniors are, you know, they're much shakier than they ought to be. Everybody with homeowners is in a shakier position than they ought to be. And so fix that so that we keep the part that people love about Prop 13. Believe me, when I ran as a Green Party candidate for governor, I would go around and talk about Prop 13, and it was like you were letting off little bombs, you know,
uh-huh.
And people would go, woo, woo. Somebody described it as not just the third rail of California politics, but it's radioactive.
The sacred cow.
Yeah, but people are starting to understand it, especially if you said we will keep that part that helped you, and as a matter of fact, help you more, because that part that helped seniors stay in their homes actually reduced the taxes more on corporations than it did on individual homeowners. It was corporate properties that got most of the benefit. But explain how the two-thirds majority to raise revenue has kept poor California, poor little rich California, in the position of the only state in the country that doesn't have an oil severance tax. Texas has it, Alaska has it, everybody else, but the oil severance fees California does not have. And there's another tax that would make a lot of sense, and it's sort of related to what I said earlier about how they had that $6.6 billion windfall because the high-income earners earned more than anybody was anticipating, anybody in our government at least. But back to the other tax, it's a Tobin tax, and it would be a small tax, probably less than 1%, on financial transactions.
Right.
That would help to curb these game-playing, gambling kind of economy-busting transactions that some folks have been doing, and it would bring in revenue.
How much revenue would these new taxes bring in?
You know, I don't have the figures offhand, but I know that the that in combination with those, they would they would either wipe out the full deficit, including the deficit that was that they took care of by cutting essential services. So it would, and I should get those figures and will, but it would wipe it out. And just in case it didn't, or that we had more needs. Going back to the tax brackets that we had just a few decades ago, where people were still able to get rich, you know, the income tax brackets. Go back to those brackets. People could still got wealthier and wealthier. You know, if that's a good thing, okay, that would still happen. And people would be paying more of their fair share. And California would continue to have the best schools in the country, if not the world, and the marvelous environment that we've had, and the chance that we gave people to, you know, whenever anybody needs help. And I know my sister at some point in her 20s was on welfare in Michigan. And at that time, this was a few decades ago, she was able to continue going to school.
Right.
She got her law degree and never was on assistance again. And it just took a couple of years, but they enabled her. They had her child was taken care of. She was able to go to school and finish her degree and move out of welfare, which is exactly what the assistance would is. You know, that's a success story in being able to give somebody assistance and not have to continue it. They can, you know, take care of themselves, but if you need help again, you've got it.
Well, Laura, you mentioned Wisconsin a little while back, and we know that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people protested Governor Scott Walker and his, you know, attack on organized labor and the rights to strike and things like that. And he's a Republican governor of Wisconsin. And so in May, we tried to do the same thing in California against Jerry Brown, and the protest was kind of co-opted by the California Teachers Association, and their main demand was that the legislature extend these regressive tax cuts. Can you talk a little bit about the hypocrisy of where's the left when we have a Democratic governor that is, and in using Jerry Brown's own words, balancing the budget off the backs of people who are already vulnerable.
And who have already gotten cuts.
Right.
And who are already paying more than their fair share of taxes. The lowest fifth of income earners in the state, the poorest fifth, pay 11 cents out of every one of the few dollars that they have. And by few dollars, I mean average $13,000 a year
right.
for a family income. whereas the top 1% that averages $2.2 million of family income, they pay under 8%. So every dollar they've got, they pay eight cents of it. So what do I think about that? That is where the people who want things to be fair in this country, and you can call them progressive, you can call them left, you can call them whatever. It's what we know when we're 9 years old. We just want things to be fair and people to have a chance. And that we need to unhook. We need to get off the Titanic. You know, mm-hmm. Do not get on the Titanic that is the Democratic Party or the Titanic that is the Republican Party. They are not going where we want to go. It's a downhill slide. So the CTA, the California Teachers Association, might this year not get cut as badly, you know, if they back Jerry Brown and back these tax extensions. But next year and the year after that, it's a downward slide. One of the refreshing or one of the inspiring things to me is that students aren't having it. You know, maybe the teachers are saying, well, yeah, okay, let's go along with this. But the students are going, wait a minute. Whether it's university students or high school students or community college, they're going, tuition fees of 32% 1 year, followed by in the high teens the next year, followed by more cuts, and they can't get their classes
right. And
their loans, which just let me put in a little plug for State Bank. We need a state bank in this state. That'll help us reduce our spending, since so much of our state spending is interest going out of state, and it would help to increase our income. We could fold what interest comes in from the better loans that the local banks and credit unions would be giving to homeowners, small businesses, and students, fold that kind of interest back into the state. So let's have a state bank. But meanwhile, the students are, in what made me think of that, student loans, my goodness, that they get out of school with $60,000, $90,000 in debt. Oh, my God. So the students aren't having it, and I hope they just stay strong. I think they will.
Well, I'm born and raised in California, and I went to elementary school in the 60s and high school and my first year of college in the 70s. And we were in California, we were prosperous. Universities were free to state residents. Jerry Brown's father, Pat Brown, governor during that period, was a huge advocate for education. And, you know, I feel like I got a really, really good public education. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why we can't go back to that. But let's shift gears for a second. And when we were in Venezuela a couple weeks ago, we went because the U.S. is imposing sanctions on Venezuela's state oil company for having the nerve to sell its oil or its products wherever they want to sell it, you know, for Venezuela having the nerve to be a sovereign state. And recently it was announced that we know that Venezuela has a huge housing crisis, so they're starting a new housing mission, and the government is expropriating lands that belong to private corporations to start building these houses on. Now, the big argument in California is, oh, if we tax the businesses, if we tax the wealthy, they'll leave. Well, my answer to that is fine. If they say they're going to hurt the people of California, then you expropriate their business and you take it and you have put it under the democratic control of the workers instead of, you know, as something that's for gross profit, run it for the workers and run it for the people of California. If the wealthy leave, fine, expropriate their land and build houses for the millions of homeless people we have here in California. What is such a scary thing about thinking about taking care of people?
Well, and people get it with the Wall Street banks, with the bailout of Wall Street that happened, they were like, wait a minute. So we're bailing out the banks. The bankers are paying themselves bonuses, retention bonuses, because they did such a good job tanking the economy.
Right.
And then with the money they had left over, they started buying up the local banks. Those were the ones that were making the good loans, like they were good neighbors, community-minded.
Right.
So people could sort of see that. It's like, wait a minute, if we're going to bail out the banks or we're going to bail out the car companies, why don't we run them? You know, they haven't been running it right, and that's
exactly
one of the ideas, again, about the state bank. But, I still run into it. You know, as I was running for governor, I was thinking that people would realize that when you lower taxes on the rich, it does not create jobs. People would still say it. It's almost like a mantra. But people are, but all of us are getting wiser and wiser about that. There was a poll that that said people basically backed the idea that Brown has of having people vote on taxes. That was a majority,
uh-huh.
And a majority also said we should tax the rich. Well, guess what? Those two things don't go together.
You know? Right.
So all we've got to do, and this is a big order, is to provide people choices that they can believe can win. You know, that they can believe can carry the day, because right now they just believe that these, you know, sorry stories of the Democratic Party who's not championed the people and the Republican Party who's not championed the people. So we're all working on it as hard as we can, but people are realizing that it's set up, it's very rigged. So we've just got to be able to take that knowledge, you know, that the students have and that so many citizens have now, a majority, and take that and have our government reflect that. So that's a challenge.
Well, Laura, we just have a few minutes left. Would you like to talk about the event that you and I are doing together in Larkspur and how people can get more information about that?
Well, yes. And that is, I'm not even sure I have a flyer right in front of me. It's on June 23rd, which is a Thursday, and it's going to be at, I don't have the flyer right in front of me. Find out about it.
Yeah.
With a task force.
Sorry, I ambushed you with that.
No.
It's going to be, Laura and I are going to be talking about the new U.S. sanctions and our trip to Venezuela. And we're going to report on our urgent trip to Caracas, because we found out on, I think it was like a Thursday that we were going, and we were on the airplane on Saturday. But that's going to be at the Redwoods Presbyterian Church at 110 Magnolia Avenue in Larkspur on June 23rd at 7:30 p.m. And you'll get a chance to hear about our trip and hear more about these ideas. And I just want to tease my listeners with Laura and I are working on something very exciting for, you know, our upcoming political climate here in California, and maybe in a couple months we'll be able to have you back on and we can talk about that.
Oh, that'll be great. Yeah. And so, and it'll be so fun. I just encourage everybody to come, and we'll talk about Venezuela in a place where schools are improving, healthcare is improving, people are participating more in their government, and the disparity of wealth is being reduced, not increased. So.
Instead of widening, like here in California,
yes.
Here in the rest of our nation.
Yes.
Well, Laura Wells, do you have a website or a way that my listeners can get a hold of you?
It's laurawells.org, and that has contact information on it. So it's just laurawells.org. And actually, if you Google Laura Governor, if you forget my last name, Laura Governor will get you there.
Well, Laura, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we'll talk to you and see you soon.
Well, thanks, and thanks for all you do.
That was our guest, Laura Wells, Green Party leader here in California.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by.
Our next guest is Nance Perry, our Detroiter. She currently lives in L.A. She's written scripts, romance, suspense, and nonfiction novels, young adult fiction, and children's books, short stories, poems, magazine, newsletter, and newspaper articles, as well as website text, technical writing, and copywriting. Aside from writing, she's also worked as a waitress, editor, PR consultant, switchboard operator, telephone market researcher, theater usher, disc jockey, sales girl, graphic designer, photographer, secretary, loan processor, and of course an actress. Her 14-year acting career ended after her 3 sexual harassment lawsuits against ABC TV, AFTRA, and the stage manager of General Hospital. Those lawsuits gave her a lot of information about sexual harassment and the law, which she used to write her ebook, How to Avoid, Handle, Litigate Over Sexual Harassment, which can be found at booklocker.com. She speaks publicly on the subject and has taught seminars based on information in her book. Nance Perry, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thanks a lot. I love being on your show. I love you. I'm so excited to know you have a show.
Oh, thank you. It's really good. This is our 101st show, so welcome to the 101st show.
Good. Thank you.
So, Nance, how did you come to write a book about sexual harassment?
I had an acting career for 14 years, and I was on General Hospital for 12 years, and the stage manager of that show was a revolting little rodent of a man who thought sexual harassment was a fun hobby. So after 14 years, a friend of mine was attacked, actually, by him on the show.
Wow.
She was in a dressing room, and when I found out that she had brought a lawsuit for sexual harassment against the network, I offered to testify with her in court if they wanted me to, because I had been harassed by him too. And in that way, I met her attorney. And when he settled her case, he asked me if I wanted to be represented. And I felt like if I didn't say yes, it was like condoning what he had done. The network knew about it. He was employed 15 years there. The network knew what he was doing. Everyone on the show knew. The union knew. I mean, everybody knew, and it was like a conspiracy of silence to let it go on. So I wanted to hold people responsible for what had been done, and I was told that I was the only one who could get in under the statute of limitations. So I said, okay, let's go for it. But I don't just want to sue the harasser. I want to sue the network and the union, because they knew what was happening and they did nothing. So I had 3 sexual harassment lawsuits. The attorney said not to say I won, just that we settled out of court, much against my will, but technically, we won. And I got a great deal of information about sexual harassment and the law, and I thought that it was important to share that with people.
Well, yes, in your book, How to Avoid, Handle, Litigate Over Sexual Harassment, I did tell everybody how they could get a hold of that book, but is your book only for people in show business?
Oh, no, not at all. When I first wrote it, it was, actually. It was called How to Avoid, Handle, Litigate Over Sexual Harassment in Hollywood. But publishers were telling me that that was too narrow a focus and not enough people would buy the book if I didn't broaden the focus. So I sat down and I tried to think of all the different lines of work that I've been in. I've done a lot of things in my day. I started to make a list, and when I got to 24, I said, you know, I think that's probably enough. So I listed those in the book, and then I started to write, expand the book and write anecdotes from my experiences in all kinds of fields. I mean, as a waitress, a secretary, sales girl, I mean, you name it, I've done it all. So the book is for everybody. And as I say, you know, don't spend another day at work without the information in this book, because it will protect you.
Well, you know, there's an old saying that prevention is the best medicine. Is there anything that we can do to prevent harassment from starting? And harassment just isn't a male-on-female thing. It's a female-on-male, it's a male-on-male, and all kinds of different variations of that. But what can we do to prevent it from even starting?
Well, be aware of your surroundings. You know, if you're on a job and you hear people talking about someone else on the job in a way, you know, as though that person is a harasser, keep your eyes open. They probably are. You know, listen to what's being said. If someone seems kind of creepy to you, you know, if the feeling of being in the same room alone with them gives you the creeps, follow your instincts. Also make sure that if you're a cell phone carrier, if you've got a cell phone where, you know, you can, like, audio tape or videotape things, always good to keep that on you. If someone's going to say something or do something, you'll be able to get it on tape. Really good idea if you feel like you're starting to be harassed. You know, sexual harassment can be very subtle. And, you know, it can be something, just a look, somebody trying to crowd you in a room or in an elevator or something, someone making little comments that don't feel quite right to you. Start to make a list and make sure that you jot down the date, the time, who did it, what was said or done, how you felt about it. That's very important, because if anything ever ends up being investigated, they're going to need to know how you felt when such and such happened. Just be aware of your surroundings. Be aware of if there are any witnesses, anyone around you. You know, if someone sexually harasses you, did anyone else see it or hear it? You know, just be aware, as you would be in any dark parking lot at night, you know. I mean, you wouldn't want to do that without being aware.
In any of the jobs that you had, and when you came across this, because it happened to me before, when felt like you were being sexually harassed or, you know, otherwise harassed, and you reported it, did you get the feeling that at that point you were the one that was being persecuted? And in this day and age of high unemployment, where most states are right to work and many people find themselves out of a job, if something like this happens and they report it and raise some kind of stink about it, is there anything you can do to prevent that from happening? I think recording it by cell phone and writing things down is a very good issue, but you know, when did you feel persecuted any time when you were actually the one that was being harassed?
Well, you know, that's the thing about sexual harassment, especially if you tell somebody, if you report it to, like, Fair Employment and Housing, or if you go as far as to get a lawyer because you've reported it and nothing has been done about it. Yeah, they will try to make you feel like, you know, you wanted it, or you know, you're lying or something. You just have to stick to your guns and know that sexual harassment is illegal, and when someone does that to you, they're breaking the law. They're committing a crime against you. And I say, don't let people commit crimes against you. I mean, you wouldn't let somebody rob you. You know, you wouldn't walk up to somebody on the street and say, want to hold me up? You know,
right.
Don't let people do things like that to you. Yeah, you risk losing your job in this. I know how bad this market is. Believe me, I've just spent most of the last 3 years unemployed. And it is really scary and really rough, and it makes you want to not say anything because you know, you're afraid of losing your job in this market, but you have to ask yourself, is any job where you have to take sexual harassment, which could go as far as molestation or even rape, is it worth it to stay on a job when those are the working conditions? You know,
well, yeah.
you have a right to the sanctity of your own body. You have the right not to be threatened, not to be coerced. And I am of the school that believes you stick up for yourself because no one else will.
Well, we definitely know that a lot of these crimes are because, you know, people feel like they're in a, you know, position of power, and they like to, you know, they get some kind of satisfaction out of that. But in your research, what did you find out that makes harassers harassers?
You know, harassers are bullies. I mean, mm-hmm. anybody who does something evil and hateful to someone else is a bully. Sexual harassers don't have any feelings of personal power and apparently don't have enough intelligence or decency to go out and, you know, donate their time to help the homeless or something to get their feelings of personal power. They would rather just abuse somebody else and feel powerful that way, and that's where it comes from, unfortunately.
Well, this is a little bit off your subject, but what do you make of the whole, what they're calling now the Wienergate scandal
yeah.
with Anthony
yeah,
Weiner?
Yeah, I was wondering if we'd talk about that today. women who are in the housekeeping industry, and it's usually women, are in a very vulnerable position because when they open a door to a room to go into clean, they don't know what they're going to find. One of these guys, I don't know if it was Wiener or the guy before him, was hiding in the bathroom and the door was closed, and when the maid came in, he popped out naked or something. And, you know, it's kind of hard to anticipate something like that. But people in that line of work have to anticipate. If it were me, I have actually contacted all of the hotels, all the big hotels in New York City, to offer my services to them as a consultant for anything they need. What I would tell them is have your housekeepers always carry two things on them. Carry pepper spray on a lanyard around their neck, and carry one of those signaling devices, you know, the commercials, I've fallen and I can't get up, remember those?
Right.
Where it's just some little device that you can either, like, pin on yourself or put on a lanyard so you can press the button and it sends for help. Those things would be good to have immediately at hand every time a housekeeper goes into a room. I would also say, you know, especially in this economy where so many people need jobs, they should hire extra security people in these hotels, even just one extra security person who can walk up and down the halls of the floors where maids are cleaning, so that in case someone is jumped out at or attacked, they'll be close by and they can give help immediately.
Okay, so we just actually did a good, you just did a really good recap of what happened to that Dominique Strauss-Kahn man who raped one of the housekeepers in a New York hotel. I think he was one of the high people up in the World Bank or something like that. But I was actually talking about the congressman in New York that was sending pictures of his new body to women on the internet.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, Anthony Weiner.
Well, you know, the women who were sent those things have proof right there that they're being sexually harassed. I mean, the guy, you have to wonder how in touch with reality the guy was if he would do something like that. It's not like something like that is going to suddenly disappear and then he can say, no, I didn't do it. I mean, they've got the picture. They can nab him, you know. That's a piece of work. You have to feel sorry for a guy who is that twisted.
Yeah, horrible lapse in common sense. What's the most important thing that you learned from your three sexual harassment lawsuits?
I would say to protect yourself and to not allow yourself to be intimidated. That's what bullies want to do. Stand up for yourself and Because if you don't nab these people, they will keep doing it, and more people will be victims. And it's so easy to just go to Fair Employment and Housing and report it and let them do the investigation on it and stuff.
So that would be to go to an outside source, not somebody within your company, you know, that might protect the person that's the harasser.
Well, you know, it's always good to start with whoever your boss is and report it, unless the harasser is your boss.
Right.
In which case, you'd have to go over your boss's head, if there is anyone over your boss's head. There may not be. In which case, you need to go to an outside source. Yeah, that's what Fair Employment and Housing is there for. It'll cost you nothing. They'll do the investigation, and they can handle everything. If you want to take it into the civil courts, you can. But I would say use that as a last resort and exhaust all other possibilities first.
If you could advise a harassment victim to do one thing, what would it be?
I'm sorry, you're cutting out. What was that?
Oh, sorry. If you could advise a harassment victim to do one thing, what would that be?
Make sure you keep a record. That's really important, because I had to get a lawyer. I had three lawsuits that I pressed, and I was asked. Actually, the harasser at General Hospital was fired, and he had he kept insisting he was innocent, and he got a lawyer from his union and had an arbitration hearing that went on for like a year or something. And I was told there were maybe 25 women who were called in to testify against him. I was one of them. And one of the people, one of the things that I was asked by the lawyers was, well, what time did this happen? Well, what exactly was said? Well, what did you do? Well, what did you think? You know, all of these, like, if you didn't have the details, it didn't happen, you know. You need to keep track. If this kind of thing is happening, the first thing you have to do is tell them it's not acceptable and stop. Because you will be asked, did you tell them to stop? As though if you didn't, it was acceptable. You know, and then
right.
If you tell them to stop and they don't, and they usually don't, keep track. If you want to stay on the job, keep track of when something happens, what was said, what was done, what time was it, how did you feel about it, were there any witnesses to it, that kind of thing, because that stuff will help you later on.
Well, Nancy, this must have been very difficult for you to do, but what kind of physical and psychological toll does harassment take on the victim?
Well, you know, it can actually make people sick. When I used to do General Hospital, I did extras in what was called under fives in General Hospital, which is five lines or less. And what we would do is we would call in for work, and then they would say, yeah, come in tomorrow. Whenever I would call in for work and they would say, yeah, we can use you tomorrow, as soon as I hung up the phone, I felt sick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all night I would feel sick to my stomach. I couldn't sleep that night. I was having anxiety attacks. I'd go to the studio the next day. I would feel queasy and you know, nervous all day if he was working there, the harasser. And then as soon as I was dismissed and I was able to leave, I felt fine. You can be made physically ill from sexual harassment. It's just not worth it.
Well, Nancy, can you tell my listeners how they can get a hold of your book one more time?
My book is on booklocker.com. If you go up on booklocker.com, up in the search box, you can either put my name, which is Nancy, N-A-N-C-E, Perry, P as in Peter, A-R-R-Y, and it will come up from my book, or just put in the title, just put in sexual harassment. My book is the longest title, How to Avoid, Handle, Litigate Over Sexual Harassment. I also have a blog now. It's sexualharassment101wordpress.com. It's sexualharassment101.wordpress.com. So if you go up on that, there's lots of information up on there, articles and all kinds of things.
Well, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Is there something else you'd like my listeners to know before we end the interview?
Cindy, thank you so much for having me on. As I've said before, please don't spend another day at work without the information in this book. Knowledge really is power, and it's the best way to protect yourself against someone being abusive to you. Know what sexual harassment is and know what you can do about it. You do have some power.
Well, Nancy Perry, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Great. Thanks, Cindy.
Well, that was our show today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you tune in again next week. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, Mikey, and you especially for listening and supporting the show. This has been Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.